and Brother Ken arrived at Jefferson Hospital. He had already died of multiple gunshot wounds. Police say that it was Philadelphia radio reporter Mumia Abu-Jamal who pulled the trigger, but no one seems to know why. As the casket of Daniel Faulkner emerged from the St. Barnabas Church in southwest Philadelphia, nearly 1,000 of his fellow officers saluted as the family strained to stand up under the pressure of today's ceremony. Faulkner's young wife, Maureen, widowed after just a year of marriage, had hoped to celebrate her husband's 26th birthday in just a few more days. Fellow officers from 165 separate police units had come. Some of Faulkner's closest friends today were his pallbearers.
It could have been any one of us. And when any police officer is murdered, the others tend to rally around not only to support the family, but to show our deep concern on this case. This is an attack on one is an attack on all.
Richard Costello, Fraternal Order of Police.
As far as I'm concerned, anyone who kills a cop, whether he's an American, African-American journalist or an Irish terrorist, murder is not a political act. It's a crime of violence. So we have no sympathy with it. When you murder a police officer, anything else that you may be about, you've given that up.
The murder of Officer Faulkner was on December 9, 1981, in the city of Philadelphia. 6 months after the shooting, still proclaiming his innocence, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who had no prior police record, was found guilty of the murder of Officer Faulkner and sentenced to death. After 14 years on death row and the failure of two appeals, Jamal has recently begun to attract national attention. A well-known civil rights lawyer has taken up his case.
Well, I've done a series of death penalty cases throughout the South and in the Northwest involving African Americans and Native Americans. And fortunately, I've never lost one.
Leonard Weinglass, Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney.
I think Mr. Weinglass had need a ladder to look a worm in the eye.
Richard Costello.
He got tried, and he got convicted, and he got sentenced, and he's going to get executed. Because as far as we're concerned, if you're going to cold-bloodedly murder a police officer, you're going to die for it. And that message has to go out far and wide, because it's the only thing that separates us from depravity.
At 4 a.m. on December 9, 1981, Jamal was driving his cab in the Philadelphia Red Light District. At a crossroads, he saw his brother William in a physical confrontation with policeman Daniel Faulkner. Jamal ran across the street to intervene. Several shots were heard. Both Faulkner and Jamal were shot. Jamal and Faulkner were taken to the hospital. The doctor in charge that night was Dr. Anthony Coletta.
I had done everything I could for Officer Faulkner, and that he was dead or dying. And I needed to leave him and move on to Mr. Jamal, who also seemed to be quite mortally injured. I felt very much alone. I had left a situation where there was a great deal of drama and many people attending to Daniel Faulkner, and it seemed to me, and it remains a very vivid memory to me, that I seemed very much alone as I began to resuscitate Mr. Jamal. He was afraid of me in the beginning, and as his surgeon and the physician responsible for his resuscitation, I needed to explain to him that I was he wasn't really sure at that point, I think at the time, who was a friend and who was a foe. I asked him his name. I tried to calm him down. I told him who I was and that I thought he was very seriously injured and that I was there to do everything I could to save his life.
I honestly would have walked past Maria because I would not have been able to recognize him.
Lydia Wallace, Abu Jamal's sister.
I mean, his forehead was gashed open and it was all blood. His lips was busted open and swollen, and there were police officers in the room and they had guns aimed on Mumia. Mumia was unconscious, and I shook his shoulder and tried to arouse him. And he said, "I'm innocent. I'm innocent. They're trying to kill me. They're trying to kill me."
6 months later, in the summer of 1982, Jamal had recovered from his wounds and was put on trial in the Central Courthouse in Philadelphia. When the trial began, Jamal's supporters thought the cards were stacked against him from the start, as he and his court-appointed lawyer faced a formidable array of prosecution witnesses and state ballistics and forensic officials. While in contrast, there were minimal resources to mount the defense.
If you're court-appointed in Philadelphia, you're given a limited amount of money to do an enormous amount of things.
Anthony Jackson, Mumia's defense attorney in 1982.
I think when all was totaled up, I think for investigative ballistics, pathologists, and other professional services, there was perhaps less than $1,000 that was used and approved by the court.
Judge Albert Szabo, the judge appointed to try the case, was known among court officials as the prosecutor's friend and in the press as the hanging judge.
Judge Szabo sets a prosecutorial tone, a conviction tone to the trial. He sets the tone to the extent that a prosecutor or a defense lawyer tries to impact on the tone of a trial. The judge makes the rulings, and that ruling, as a result, sets where you go from that point on.
The first stage of the trial was jury selection. Under Pennsylvania law, at a trial that can result in a death sentence, potential jurors can be successfully challenged and removed if they do not believe in capital punishment. The prosecution initially excluded more than half of the jury pool on the basis that they didn't believe in the death penalty. Many of these potential jurors were black. The prosecution then used its peremptory challenges to exclude 11 other black jurors. The jury finally contained only two black jurors from a city that was 40% black. But more was to come. Jamal's frustration with what was happening finally exploded when the judge stopped him from further representing himself at the trial, citing his intimidating behavior in the jury selection stage as the reason.
He did everything he could to basically disrupt the proceedings, including not standing, for example, not recognizing. Everybody would stand for the judge as he would come out, and Mr. Jamal would just sit right here and stay, not move at all.
Joseph McGill, prosecutor.
The judge allowed it to go for a while and continued to allow it to go. Even so far as at some times, what Mr. Jamal said is, "I don't recognize you as Judge Szabo. You're no judge. I don't recognize you. You're not a judge. This is not the law."
Well, you know, they always tried to paint Mumia as some wild creature, you know, out of control. And in fact, Mumia was in control as much as he could be. And usually Mumia was trying to make a point when they asked him to be removed from the courtroom. When people were trying to take your life, you don't go, "Oh, excuse me, should I do this or shouldn't I do that? I mean, I'm not going to be timid if I'm fighting for my piece of bread." So we're talking life here.
The prosecution's case put forward at the trial was that Officer Faulkner stopped Jamal's brother's car at the corner of 13th Street and Locust. When the brother got out of the car, there was an argument. Faulkner was seen to hit the brother. Jamal ran across the street from the parking lot opposite.
And he runs over and takes out this Charter Arms revolver and fires and shoots the officer in the back.
Joseph McGill, prosecutor.
The officer then manages to turn around a little bit because of the momentum of the bullet. It did not affect the vital organs at that time, and was able to get off a shot at that time, which hit Mr. Jamal in the chest area. He then, that is, Officer Faulkner, continued to fall down. And as he fell down straight on the pavement area, he was, for all intents and purposes, debilitated. The defendant, Mr. Jamal, at this point, having been stopped and went over and straddled the officer, took both hands and held the weapon that he pulled out previously and fired four times. There were only five cartridges in the weapon. All five were fired. The casings were kept in the revolver at that time. One of the shots, that is the second shot or third shot, we don't know which, actually went through the in between the eyes of the officer's head. That was the killing bullet.
The gun was found on the ground. It was Mumia's gun. It was licensed to him. He had purchased it.
Len Weinglass.
He had been robbed twice, as recently as three nights before this happened. And he was carrying a gun for his own protection. But that gun was a .38 caliber. And the bullet that was removed from Officer Faulkner, if you accept the word of the medical examiner, was a .44 caliber.
This inconsistency from the medical examiner's report was never introduced at the trial. The report shows that he recorded that the bullet that hit Officer Faulkner in the head was a .44 caliber shot. He would later claim that this was a preliminary report. The prosecution would add that the measurement of the bullet in the ballistics report was consistent with a .38 and not a .44. However, there was no definitive match. The defense contends that since the bullet was fragmented and one piece was lost after the autopsy, the caliber of the bullet is now impossible to identify. In addition to this, there were no fingerprints on the gun.
Also, although the gun was found there, the prosecution was unable to connect that gun to the murder itself. They did not check the gun to see if it had been recently fired. That could have easily been accomplished. They did not check Mumia's hands to see if he had any lead residue. They did not do a neutron activation test. So, in short, the prosecution benefited by the fact that Mumia, an all-night cab driver, had a gun, but they were unable to connect the gun to the murder itself.
You're listening to excerpts of a video documentary that we have had made for audio by the Prison Radio Project and Noah Hanrahan called Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt. And we'll be back with the documentary in a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
This is KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno. It's 9:42. Stay tuned at 10 o'clock for Music of the World right here on 94.1.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the documentary originally made for HBO and Britain's Channel 4 called Mumia, A Case for Reasonable Doubt.
The prosecution's expert maintained that Jamal fired the first shot into Officer Faulkner's back at close range. He said Jamal was just 12 inches away, but the expert admitted he could find no evidence of gunpowder on the policeman's jacket in his tests. Jamal was unable to counter this testimony with experts of his own. We brought in one of America's top forensic experts who has testified for both the prosecution and the defense in hundreds of trials, Herbert McDonnell. McDonnell tested an identical gun at different distances from the target and found obvious gunpowder traces.
This is the pattern produced at 12 inches, and it continues on, as I have shown and marked, at 24 inches. We still get a lot of powder granules producing this image. If they got no test at all, it would have to be more than 24 inches.
If the prosecution did the tests as they said, and there were no gunpowder traces, the shot in the back seems likely to have been fired from further away. These issues raise additional questions about the certainty of the prosecution's description of events. The other point in the prosecution's forensic evidence was that Jamal was then shot by Faulkner as he fell. But Jamal was hit in the chest and the bullet traveled downwards. How could the policeman have fired at that angle as he fell? One theory put forward at the trial was that there was a ricochet effect, with a bullet hitting a bone and being deflected downwards.
No, I couldn't buy that at all. If the bullet hit a rib, and when you have a high-velocity projectile, a jacketed projectile such as this, the deflection of the rib in that area is not going to cause a severe deflection. It might move a degree or two, but we're looking here at perhaps 30 or 40 degrees downward, and I don't believe that could possibly happen.
Such questionable arguments make a number of other scenarios seem just as possible. What does McDonald make of the forensic work carried out by the police after the shootings?
The fact that they did not even smell of the barrel or the cylinder of the revolver to determine if it had been recently fired, that's not very forensic, that's common sense. They should have done the forensic test, particularly neutron activation swabbing, and they should have done the spatial distribution of gunshot residues. And if they did them, they did not report on them. And those are two fundamental things. But having an expert at the table with counsel would have been very helpful in this case, because I think much of what I have read would have been seriously questioned and perhaps destroyed by a good cross-examination, which could not be effected because there was no forensic scientist there.
The next major issue in the case against Jamal concerns a confession that Jamal is alleged to have made while in the hospital after the shooting. The police still proclaim it as firm evidence of Jamal's guilt.
He bragged about it when he got to the hospital. Despite his alleged brutal treatment, he was sufficiently coherent enough to say, "Yeah, I shot the MF, and I hope he dies." Well, he got his wish. Danny died.
Philadelphia police officer Gary Bell said later that he heard Mumia's confession in the hospital.
I walked over to him to look at to see who had just shot and killed my partner, and he had shouted out that I shot the MF-er and I hope he dies. He said it once more, and I leaned over and responded that he shouldn't die, you should.
In fact, Officer Bell reported this alleged confession to no one for 2.5 months before he gave a statement to a police colleague that Jamal had confessed. Was the confession story concocted by the police? In interviews with homicide detectives in the days immediately after the shootings, none of the 15 or so policemen who were in Jamal's immediate vicinity mentioned a confession. Indeed, one police officer, Gary Waxhall, who was with Jamal in the hospital after the shooting, reported that, quote, the Negro male made no comments. During a recent hearing, Gary Waxhall claimed that in spite of his statement that night, he too had heard Jamal's confession, but he was too upset to report it at the time, and, like Gary Bell, had only seen fit to mention it more than 2 months later.
I would make it clear that I was with Jamal from within a moment or two of him being brought into the emergency room.
Dr. Anthony Coletta.
Throughout his entire time in the emergency room and on into intensive care unit, and he neither made any confessions to me, nor did he say anything that would be even remotely in the way of a confession to any other individuals.
You wrote about this in your notes at the time, the confession. How did that come out?
I didn't write any notes at that time. I made no notes. I talked to detectives at a later date and informed them of the statement.
At 4 a.m. on December 9th, 1981, there were no streetlights on the corner of the street where the incident happened, only the light of the police car. There was a lot of confusion about what the witnesses actually saw. Cynthia White was the prosecution's chief eyewitness. She claimed she was standing on the corner close to the incident. But another witness, Jesse Hightower, insists that Cynthia White was not where she says she was at all.
When I spied her, her positioning was at least a half a block from the corner of the incident, at least a half a block.
Cynthia, a young, unfortunate woman, 38 arrests for prostitution. She had 3 open cases that were still in the process of being worked on. She was serving 18 months for prostitution arrest in Boston. We have 2 witnesses. One has her moments before a half a block away. Another witness has her just as the shooting was breaking out down the street, and that she came running up afterwards and asked people what happened. As you know, someone testified during the trial, Veronica Jones, another prostitute, who said that she was offered the same deal as Cynthia by the police, that if she would finger Mumia as the shooter of Officer Faulkner, she could work her corner without molestation from the police.
But transcripts of the trial show that when the prostitute Veronica Jones referred to the police offering a deal if she corroborated Cynthia White's story, the prosecutor objected. Veronica Jones was one of four eyewitnesses who in their initial statement said they saw someone running from the scene. But when Jones got to court, she denied having said it. She had a police record, as did another witness who changed his story. In fact, the only one of these four to come to court and stand by his original statement was Desi Hightower.
When I heard the shots, I stayed behind the wall for some odd seconds till the shots ceased. And as I turned on the 13th Street, I seen a gentleman fleeing from the scene by the movement of his hair. He was moving pretty fast. This happened right before the police pulled up, and Jamal was on the ground. So when the police came up, they just started to attack him and the other gentleman. And if it was a man, it looked to be a man, the statue, the bill, had already fled the scene.
With the other witnesses changing their stories, who could corroborate Desi Hightower? There was another witness, Debbie Kredansky. In her statement to the police on the night of the shooting, she testified that she heard the shots and police sirens, and looking out of the window, saw a man running down the south side of Locust Street. But Jamal's defense only started to pursue her as a witness during the trial.
We get her statement, we have her name, her address is then cut out. There's a hole in the sheet.
Anthony Jackson, the original defense attorney.
As it turned out, we could never get her address. We asked the prosecution. In fact, the prosecution would not give us her address. Look, it may have been that if I had her address, I went out and talked to her, she'd say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Maybe. But why would the prosecution not take that chance? The prosecution prevented that opportunity from happening. Why, I don't know.
However, police say they routinely remove witnesses' addresses. When Jackson was given Debbie Kardansky's phone number by the prosecutor, she told Jackson she had recently been in an accident and felt she was in no condition to testify.
This woman would be straight down the middle. She had no prosecutorial bent or defense bent. She was a white woman in her middle ages. I've since learned all of these things. And she lived at the hotel, didn't know Mumia, didn't know the police. Said, hey, I heard a shot. I looked out the window and I saw someone run. There is little likelihood that she's going to make it up or lie. She said that it never got into testimony. It never corroborated what Desi Hightower said. So what Desi Hightower said was an aberration and something the jury perhaps just easily discounted.
I told the state and I told the world what I seen that night. That's what I seen. I'm not lying for him. And I wouldn't lie against him. I'm just simply telling the truth.
I am absolutely innocent of the charge I was charged of. I'm absolutely not guilty of the charges I were convicted of. How did you feel at the point, I mean, when you handed the death sentence back in 1982? Well, I guess... angry, intensely angry. A feeling of injustice that rankled to the core of my soul. Anger, injustice, outrage, fear, you know, mixed emotions from the whole world, but a certainty that it would not stand, a certainty that it would be overturned. I still feel that.
By 1981, the year of Faulkner's murder, Jamal was an award-winning freelance journalist and broadcaster. But even so, he needed to supplement his income.
Anyone who's ever written freelance knows that you were poorly paid, if ever, if at all. And I was doing stringer work for several stations. I was driving a cab to make money to support my family. You at some point decided you needed a gun to protect you. Could you tell us about it? Well, I would wager that 85% of all cabbies in America ride armed. If they don't,
Sometimes they don't come back from their shift. I've been robbed before. I recall vividly, even now, the experience of picking up a fare, going to a site, looking in the mirror, and seeing a man behind me with a 380, you know, or 45, I don't remember, a semi-automatic weapon behind me. You don't forget about that, you know. That becomes a necessity of that job.
Faced with what he regarded as a hostile judge who refused him his right to represent himself, Jamal never gave his account of the events of December 9, 1981 at the trial. In an impassioned statement at the trial, he rejected the opportunity to take the stand, saying he wanted all of his rights, not some of them. Now, in the process of seeking an appeal, Jamal has decided not to give a full account at this stage. The nearest he has got to describing what happened that night is in his recent book. In a passage of surreal, almost abstract prose, Jamal describes his sensation of moving in and out of consciousness after he was shot.
I'm sleeping, sort of. It has the languorous feel of sleep with none of the rest. Time seems slower, easier, less oppressive. I feel strangely light. I look down and see a man slumped on the curb, his head resting on his chest, his face downcast. Damn, that's me. A jolt of recognition ripples through me. A cop walks up to the man and kicks him in the face. I feel it. Don't feel it. Three cops join the dance, kicking, blackjacking the bloody, handcuffed, fallen form. Two grab each arm, pull the man head first into a steel utility pole. He falls. Daddy? Yes, baby girl. Why are those men beating on you like that? It's okay, baby girl. I'm okay.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt, the original video distributed by Fox Lorber and produced by Atmore. It was adapted for radio by Noel Hanrahan. We'll bring you the rest of that documentary on Monday. And finally, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton was released from prison just as we were broadcasting today. He was serving a 90-day sentence for protesting the U.S. Navy's continued bombing of Vieques.
If they fought that these 90 days cooled me off, they are mistaken. If they thought it made me have a second thought about civil disobedience, they don't understand that this is bigger than 90 days. If I have to do 90 more, I will not give up my dignity. I will not give up my beliefs. I will not give up my convictions.
And that does it for today's historic broadcast from the historic Firehouse and Downtown Community Television in Chinatown. Democracy Now! Is produced by our Brain Trust, Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Special thanks to Errol Maitland and Reem Kahuda in Philadelphia. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting contributes to Pacifica Radio, and we'd like to thank our Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, as well as the Pacifica affiliates. All of that means all of you. We are Pacifica. From our studios in exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king?
Join us this Friday night, August 17th at 10 o'clock as we present the second of two broadcasts from the 12th Annual Eddie Moore Jazz Festival at Yoshi's in Oakland, presented by Jazz in Flight. On Friday night at 10 o'clock, we'll be presenting the Paul Motion Quintet. Paul is one of the most influential modern percussionists, having largely freed the drummer, one of the things that he has done, from strict timekeeping duties and being a very atmospheric and sensitive player. playing with Bill Evans and going on to play with all kinds of great people, Keith Jarrett among them.